Greetings, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. This is Terry Patton. I'm the creator and host of the series, and for anybody who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I created this series in order to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a role in helping human beings rise to meet our current intractable challenges to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on this planet. So this is part of a series of remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, I'm joined by Daniel P. Brown. We'll continue that discussion in a conversation we're titling The Path to Everything Good. The ways that this will work is I'll introduce Dan, and then he and I will spend about an hour having a real conversation. And then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and we'll finish up overall in about 90 minutes or perhaps slightly longer. Daniel P. Brown is the director of the Center for Integrative Psychotherapy in Newton, Mass. He's an associate clinical professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and the author of 14 books, including Transformations of Consciousness with Ken Wilber and Jack Engler, and a remarkable text on Mahamudra, today's topic, Pointing Out the Great Way, as well as two books of public dialogues with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He's done extensive study in the Pali, Sanskrit, and Tibetan languages and has spent many years translating numerous important Tibetan meditation texts. He's studied meditation practice for 38 years, beginning with reading Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and its main commentaries in the original Sanskrit, then studying Burmese Theravadan Buddhist mindfulness meditation, and then deepening via many practices across 3 decades of dedicated practice in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. As a Western psychologist, he spent 10 years translating and conducting outcomes research on beginning and advanced meditators. He has taught meditation retreats for 20 years. He's also an internationally recognized expert on attachment, trauma, memory, and hypnosis. What I especially appreciate about Dan is his remarkable combination of virtues. On one hand, he's an erudite, brilliant, hardworking Buddhist scholar and translator. On the other, he's really a deep meditation teacher. I did a meditation retreat with him in the Boston area this January, and it was a remarkable experience. On another hand, he's a humanitarian who's launched some really beautiful charitable projects in Asia. And at the same time, he's a regular guy, an Irish working-class son who still roots for the Boston sports teams and relishes a good meal, as well as fighting the good fight against corrupt institutions in his work as a legal expert witness, and who speaks not just authoritatively, but with a down-to-earth, very human voice, whatever the topic, high or low. So welcome, Dan. I'm really happy to have you on the program today.
Happy to be here. Hi.
Hey. Yeah. Can you begin maybe by orienting us, maybe offer us a description to the pointing out approach to Mahamudra meditation and how it differs from other approaches and why you came to teach that way?
Well, I team taught meditation for about 20 years with a number of Tibetan lamas, and then the lamas don't really know how to teach much in the West. They do a lot of either preliminary practices or they talk more abstractly about advanced practices, but the idea of step-by-step clear instructions is the exception rather than the rule. And after struggling to teach together, I was talking with His Holiness the Dalai Lama at one point, and he said, "Can you stay around? There's someone I want you to meet." And he said he's very unusual because Tibetans don't usually talk about attainments. The ethics are that you don't talk about any personal experiences with meditation because it could lead to spiritual pride. So it's not done, but he said this lama will tell you in exquisite detail everything about each stage. And then I met the lama, and he did a live demonstration of inner fire practice, the energy meditation practice, while he was doing it. He explained in technical precision all the stages of it for continuously for the next 6 hours, and it was a stunning demonstration. And what was clear is that what he was showing me is a style of how to teach, where you give extremely detailed instructions and walk the person right through it. It's a style of meditation that was popular in what was called the tradition of the 84 masters, or 84 siddhas, from about 600 to about 1050 A.D., before the rise of the monastic tradition. And they were wandering yogis who would literally sing people into awakening with little song poems called dohas. And style of teaching is called directly pointing out. You get a detailed inscription of every stage of the practice, then you do it, and it's guided. And you talk about it as part of the relationship so that we can correct any problems that come up right on the spot and keep you moving forward with it. So that's called nurtura, or directly pointing out in Tibetan. And it's a relational-based way of teaching, which is, I think His Holiness thought was very useful for Westerners.
Yeah. Well, it's remarkable. It's the way you teach really is quite unique, and it has so much detail and specificity, it really stands out. I'm also interested maybe to ask you, before we get into the guts of things, one of the points that you have made very strongly, and I think importantly, has been the fact that there is really a whole path to awakening available in the tradition of Buddhist meditation, which is much deeper and more profound than many people realize.
Well, there's actually three paths. There are three maps here. There's a map that takes you from the beginning to get a taste of awakening, or what I call little flames of awakening, and then there's a whole other map and a whole other set of procedures to stabilize the awakening. So you have it all the time, on and off the pillow. And then there's a third map that, when you have continuous awakening, it brings you to full Buddhahood. So the maps are remarkably detailed.
Yeah, and part of what you've emphasized a lot is the fact that this is not equivalent to mindfulness, which is what many people think of when they think of Buddhist meditation.
Well, In Tibetan or in Buddhist terms, there are what's called the three turnings of the wheel of the Dhamma. And you can think of those in Western terms sort of like scientific revolutions, when there are paradigm shifts. In each turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, where there were remarkable new discoveries that sort of were very different from the previous wheel of the Dhamma. So the first turning of the wheel was the teachings of Buddha Shakyamuni and the Four Noble Truths. And most of the path that was articulated, particularly in a stage-by-stage model for that level of practice, would be the Visuddhimagga, translated into English as the path of purification from Pali. And that path is really about liberation from suffering. And that's the main contribution. In the second turning of the wheel, the Mahayana, there was a significant more revision over 500 years of emptiness practice, and that's just not something that's part of that first turning of the wheel. And there's it leads to a very different opening up. And then the third turning of the wheel were the essence traditions: Great Seal of Mahamudra, Great Completion or Dzogchen, and the Tantras. And there, the emphasis was on the fact that we all have Buddha nature. It's part of our hardwiring. We're already awake. But there are many habits of mind that clouded over. sort of like the sun always shines, but we don't see it because of the clouds. When the rain clouds clear away, we say the sun has just came out. Is that correct? No, the sun's always out. But you don't see it as long as there are clouds. And awakening mind is always radiantly shining forth every moment. But clouds make it so that we don't see it. So in the essence tradition, the practices are to clear up the clouds. But in the essence traditions, there's much more emphasis not just on eradicating negative states of mind, but the flourishing of the positive states of mind. There are 80 positive states of a fully developed Buddha mind. So it's a very different kind of outcome. So the notion of the flourishing of the positive is not something you're going to find in mindfulness. And also in the essence traditions, since the meditations open up a level that's beyond time, it opens up what's called all the levels of all at onceness. So you end up with a mind that operates on multiple levels of reality at once. And that's a remarkably different outcome. Rei Chung, who was the main student of Milarepa, says that there are different levels of awareness. Mindfulness is one level of awareness, but you can open up a whole bunch of others beyond that level. So not all Buddhist traditions are the same. They lead to different ends. And they're all useful. And each builds on the other.
Now, maybe it's good for us to begin with that first stage. And when I asked you the orienting question of the series about how higher consciousness can help the human species rise to meet the crisis in our world today, you were very clear you wanted to talk about it in terms of this path. Even though on the surface we're facing a lot of fast-moving trends, and many of which seem quite threatening, and it seems like it will take a long time for large numbers of people to really advance in their practice. But this is where you started, and with that you start with concentration. And it might be good to orient us to why.
Well, within the Mahayana, there are the usual stages. There are three stages. There's concentration, and then there's the insight practices, and then there are the advanced insights, or what are called extraordinary insight practices, and then those lead to a taste of awakening to the true nature of the mind. So that's the model here that we're going to operate out of it. But I just want to go back to a comment they just made, which I would disagree with, and I don't think that awakening is measured in time. The idea that it takes a long time is just the empty construction of mind. All of this is available any moment, and it's simpler than you think.
So let's get into it then. You pointed out the first stage of the path, concentration, is an antidote for distractibility.
This is the path within the domain of the Mahayana. It's the second turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel I'm going to talk about. But it starts with concentration. And in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism, concentration meditation really stems from Asanga in the year 506 AD. And he sort of, in his meditations, downloaded a complete path of concentration. And then in India, and then when Buddhism made its way to Tibet, that sort of stuck, so that the Asanga path of concentration is it's standard in all Tibetan systems of meditation. It's called in Tibetan the Semne Gu, which means the nine stages of the mind staying. When you concentrate, the purpose is to get the mind to stay on the concentration object. So these are the different refinements or levels of the degree to which you get the mind to stay on the concentration object. It was the great American psychologist over 100 years ago, William James, who said that when he started looking into his own mind, he saw it to be the, quote, buzzing, booming confusion of the ordinary mind. Our mind is chaotic. It jumps from one thing to another. When we try and put the mind on something and get it to stay and concentrate, William James estimated that it stays on for about 3 seconds before it goes off into distraction by something else. Unfortunately, modern neuroimaging studies have shown that William James was mostly right. As a species, we're highly distractible. And unless we train the mind with, say, concentration. In Tibetan Buddhism, the mind is likened to be a wild elephant. Elephants are very smart and they're very strong, but they also get very afraid. So if you scare an elephant on an elephant preserve, it will run wild and stampede it and cause a lot of damage. So usually we think of the ordinary mind to be like an elephant out of control. It runs all over the place and scatters here and there, and it doesn't stay put. And Mike Csikszentmihalyi, the modern psychologist who did the research on flow, coined the term psychic entropy. The mind is entropic. The ordinary mind jumps from one thing to another, and it's disordered. But he also discovered something that's been around in the meditation traditions for several thousand years. If you systematically train the mind to pay attention, it has an organizing and orderly effect on the mind. The more you train attention, the more orderly the mind becomes. And there's a path here, a whole systematic path unfolds, and the key to opening that path is training concentration. So when you train concentration, using the elephant metaphor, we say you tie the rope of mindfulness onto a concentration object, just like tying a chain around the elephant's neck to a stake, and every time the elephant wanders off, it feels the pull of the chain and pulls itself back, and it wanders off again, and you pull it back, and it wanders off again, and you pull it back, and over time the elephant learns that it's not going to go anywhere, so it settles down. And like that, if you tie the rope of mindfulness onto a concentration object and keep pulling it back every time it wants to go off to distraction, either by distraction by thought or distraction by sense experience. If you keep pulling it back to the concentration object through a process of learning, it will eventually just settle down and stay on the object as long as you want. Staying, the Tibetan word is nepa, which literally means to stay. The mind will stay for hours without going anywhere else once you train it. So the purpose of concentration is to train staying. The opposite of staying is distraction. The mind wanders off to where you don't want it to go. So if you train concentration, it has a stabilizing effect on the mind, and you make the mind a stable point of observation so that in the later insight meditations you can use that stable point of observation to look into how the mind constructs its own experience and gain insight into the basic operations of how the mind works, ultimately leading to awakening. But the path starts with concentration training. There are several tools of concentration that are important in the Asanga tradition. And the first is called semtang in Tibetan, and that means steering the mind, like much like in a steering wheel. In a car, when you can think of learning to concentrate the mind much like learning to drive a car. At first it seems overwhelming, but after not so long it gets pretty straightforward. So when you try and train the mind and select a concentration object, the first goal is to keep directing the mind repeatedly back, and every time it goes off you steer it back, and every time it goes off you steer it back. It's a good idea to think about it in terms of movement. It's either the intentional movement of the mind towards the concentration object, or there's the spontaneous movement towards distraction. And if you have to stir it back many, many times, so what? The cumulative effect of that over time is that the mind will stay for longer and longer periods of time. So some years ago at Harvard in the 1970s, then graduate student Michael Fort did his dissertation on meditation, and what he did was have people who never meditated before stare at a candle flame for exactly 20 minutes, and he had a little mercury switch on their baby fingers so that every time they wandered off from focusing on the concentration object, they would twitch their baby finger and the computer could record it. And he did a spectral analysis of patterns of distraction over time as beginners learn to meditate. He found there were three stages. At first, they repeatedly had to steer their mind back to the candle flame. And then after a while, there'd be periods that they would stay for maybe 5 minutes without any distraction, and there'd be equal periods of getting lost in daydreams for 5 minutes. So the periods of staying got longer, and the periods of distraction got longer. And then there was a third phase where all that distraction sort of stopped, and they just stayed on the object for quite a bit of time. And in our observations of many people who've gone through these retreats over the last 40 years, his observations in his dissertation have been borne out. That's a pretty good description of the stages that people go through when they're trying to train concentration meditation. We now have some good neuroimaging studies on what happens during concentration meditation. There's a part of the prefrontal system in the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex, or the ACC, and it's sort of the attention distribution center of the brain, or circuitry of the brain. So when you're involved in competing attention tasks, that's the area of the brain that gets activated. A common way of studying that in psychology is with a test called the Stroop test, where if I were to show you an index card with a text printed clearly and the word on the text was red but the color was green, that's a competing attention task. Do you pay attention to the text or the color? Because they're different. And it takes more effort to focus on either the color or the text. And in tasks like that, the ACC, the anterior cingulate cortex, is the area of the brain that lights up. It means effortful concentration to focus on one thing as opposed to another. The ACC is that area of the brain that's underactive in children and adults that have attention deficit disorder. Ritalin is successful in treating attention deficit disorder because it selectively activates the ACC and puts it back online. When people go and get hypnotized, the hypnotic induction ceremony activates the ACC when they go into hypnotic trance. When people are training concentration meditation, like the Asanga elephant path, as we call it, the nine stages of staying, they activate the ACC. The brain is sort of an equal opportunity employer. It doesn't make any difference whether you use mind-body techniques like hypnosis or concentration meditation, or whether you use medication. They all have a common pathway in activating the ACC and putting it back online. But in this modern generation of neurobiology, we know a lot about what's called neuroplasticity of the brain, that the brain actually changes structure and size depending on use. So if you use certain areas of the brain, the volume will increase, just like muscle mass increases if you exercise a lot. And if you don't use certain areas of the brain, the volume decreases. And the actual structure changes. There are two studies now that show that when people train concentration and get fairly proficient in it, the volume of the ACC actually increases and the composition of white and gray matter within the ACC actually increases also. So what that translates in terms of practical experiences, it's hard work to train yourself do concentration meditation, but at a certain point, if you learn it well, you don't lose the skill anymore. You keep it. And that, of course, has practical implications in everyday living. You don't have to, in any job that you have, the capacity to pay careful attention and not be distracted is useful. For example, I teach a course in performance excellence here in Massachusetts that's been popular amongst judges. It's taught it for Superior Court judges twice, and for district court judges, and for family court judges, and one of my students is a dean of a law school. We just wrote a paper for a law review on concentration training for lawyers and law professors and judges. So, in any profession, the capacity to pay careful attention would be considered a useful way to improve work performance and performance excellence. So, these meditation methods have direct contribution to everyday living in that sense. I'm a trauma and abuse expert, so I spend a lot of time in courts testifying about abuse cases, and that often requires having to memorize crates of records and have the material at my fingertips, and I don't think I could do that efficiently without the years of concentration training. It's quite useful for that.
That was very helpful. Now, that's got something to do with also a social condition, the distractibility of everyone today, which seems to be intensifying.
Distractibility. Attention deficit disorder is the metaphor for modern culture.
Yeah. And everybody who's listening to this is dealing with countless interruptions, more than they had 5 or 10 years ago, now with texts and tweets and emails and
There are a number of studies that show that multitasking is an illusion. In other words, people get the idea that they're more efficient, but actually the attention is at a deficit. There's a small group of exceptional people who are what we call super multitaskers, but for the most people, multitasking actually causes further attention deficits. Better concentration, and then go back to the issue of multitasking once you have a fully trained mind. For example, in the Tibetan Tantras, they've calculated that you can do 7 things at once. But those are in highly skilled concentrators.
And in the middle of daily life, in addition to meditation practice, are there particular coping skills or strategies or practices that you recommend to people to deal with this epidemic of distractibility that everybody's coping with?
Well, I'm favorable to people learning the basics of concentration meditation. And you mentioned mindfulness earlier. Concentration meditation is different from mindfulness meditation. Concentration has to do with nepa, the capacity to stay on the object of concentration for as long as you want without distraction elsewhere. The mind just, whatever you intend the mind on, it goes just to that, stays on that, with no extraneous thought activity. That's useful. Mindfulness has more to do with the continuity of non-reactive awareness, but is not necessarily something that trains concentration. The Asanga Elephant Path has much more detail to it in terms of a concentration method than the Burmese mindfulness that is popular in this country. And the reason for that is because in the Asanga Elephant Path, there are 2 tools for concentration. One is semtan, directing the mind like a steering wheel. But once you direct the mind to the concentration object, then the next thing that you do, the next tool you use, is called timpa. Timpa means to intensify. You look so closely into the object, as one sutra says, stick your nose in the object, that you're so closely engaged that the mind's too busily engaged with the concentration object. It simply doesn't have the occasion to go anywhere else. So if you add the practice of intensifying to directing the mind, in Western terms we would say directing and then facilitating or engaging more fully, if you add that second tool, then concentration is far more efficient, and it tends to go towards deeper states of concentration that you'll get with just pure mindfulness training. There's no concept of intensifying in the Burmese mindfulness tradition. It's very popular in this country. And I say that as a friend because I went to Burma and studied that with Mahasi Sayadaw, who was the originator of Burmese mindfulness back in the 1970s. It's just that the Asanga method is more refined for pure concentration, and I think it's better suited for what Westerners need because we're so distractible.
Yeah, this is such an important foundation. I found that this was one of the richest things that I got from my retreat training and my subsequent practice, informed by what you offer. But it is clarified by what follows, which is basic emptiness training. And you've said that recognizing the emptiness of self and of all that is arising really helps us recognize and free ourselves from all the experiences in life that have grab, which is really the cause of suffering. I'd love to invite you to elaborate about that.
Okay, I should say a little bit about emptiness, what it is and what it isn't. But in the older Buddhism, the first turning of the wheel, there were three insights that you got about the mind. The first was dukkha, or if you look at your experience every moment, you'll notice the mind moves towards what it likes to make more of it and moves away from what it likes, dislikes to make less of it. And that is dukkha in Pali. It's often translated as the truth of suffering, but it's not a good translation. It really means reactivity. That kind of incessant reactivity of moving towards to make more of what you like and moving away from what you don't like, the end result is suffering, but technically, what the Buddha was trying to describe is you can actually observe that reactivity at very high speeds in your own information processing system. And if you observe it in a certain way, you can get free of it, leading to the liberation from suffering. But that was the first turning of the wheel, and that was the first insight. The second insight was impermanence. If you look at your mind, everything changes. It's never the same. And the third was called anatta, which is more problematic. It means no self. And what it means, if you spend a lot of time concentrating, then thought elaboration will wind down and mostly stop. And at some point, your sense of self, which is a kind of elaboration, will wind down and sort of temporarily get deconstructed so that while you're meditating, it's no longer, it wouldn't be Dan meditating or Terry meditating. It would be awareness itself that's guiding the meditation. And that's as far as the first turning of the wheel Buddhism went in terms of the notion of self. Then there was about 500 years of careful refinement of that concept, and what came out was something rather different from that, and that's the notion of emptiness. And what emptiness means, it's an unfortunate term, I don't like it very much, but a good synonym for emptiness is merely a construction, or just a construction of mind. And Mahayana Buddhism is a constructivist theory of mind, that everything is a construction. And that's useful. But there are two levels of truth. One is relative truth, where everything is constructed. And then there's ultimate truth, where we have to be able to see that you're just constructions and not reify them, not make them too real. So let's take, for example, the psychological sense of self. Western self-psychologists tell us that infants don't come into the world with a psychological sense of self. We develop the psychological sense of self peaks at around 18 months. And that's not an accident because it's between 12 and 24 months that we develop the capacity for representational thinking. And the outcome of that is to be able to represent the self and to represent attachment relationships. So once we develop that sense of self in relative reality, it's useful. First, it gives us a sense of being a central organizing principle. I organize my reality every day in around Dan-ness. You organize it around Terry-ness. So the sense of self becomes a central organizing principle. It also provides us with a sense of coherence of mind. If I have a sense of self, everything hangs together in my internal experience in a coherent way. Thirdly, having a sense of self provides a a kind of continuity across time, space, and state, despite all the remarkable developmental stages I'll go through in my life. There's a sense of sameness throughout all of that. I still feel like the same person. If I'm in different locations, I just came back from teaching in Australia, and now I'm back in Boston. And I feel like the same person in both those environments. So in relative reality, having a psychological sense of self is useful as a central organizing principle. That's the great contribution of Western, say, self-psychology. But the problem of that, as the Buddhists say, is the problem of, in Tibetan it's called nojin. Nojin really means to hold it to be too real or too solid. I forget that it's simply a representation, and I take it to be real. I actually take Dan way too seriously, and I think it's an independently existing entity, a thing that's out there. And nojin is sort of like, in Western philosophy, the notion of things in themselves. And what Buddhists say, that there are no things in themselves. Everything exists because of causes and conditions, which is similar to what in Western science we call interaction effects. The reason why I have a psychological sense of self is because I have a mind that has the capacity for representational thinking. And those interactions are what allows that to be in relative reality. And that's useful as long as I'm dwelling in relative reality, like talking with you right now and trying to organize my thoughts around this interview. But what the Buddhists come in and say, the Mahayana Buddhists, is look, once we develop that, we tend to reify it. We make it too real. And there are two consequences from reifying a structure of mind and making it too solid. One is dzinpa, and I like to translate that as grab. The self has a lot of grab. So if you don't like this talk, grab. I'll feel criticized and I can feel the grab. If you like it and praise me, grab. If I'm sick, the body self has a lot of grab. So you can go, grab is perceivable. You can look at all the experiences in your everyday life and you can directly perceive the grab. And grab in Mahayana Buddhism, the grab of self is what leads to suffering. And the second consequence of the reification of structures of mind and making them too solid or real is mumpa, the capacity to obscure. The self becomes like a cloud that clouds over the true nature of awareness. And it's not just the self. All the structures of mind become too solid. The world as out there becomes too solid. My thoughts become too solid and real. My emotions become too solid and real. Perceptions become too solid and real. Time becomes too solid and real. We know from Western psychology that the sense of time develops much more slowly than the sense of self. Children have a narrative structure at about 4 years of age. They can know that stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. But the calendrical structure of time, that is, be able to take personal memories and sort them into what month or year they occurred over time in some larger time frame, isn't really in place until about 8 years of life, concurrent with Piaget's intelligent stages of concrete operational thinking. So time as a structure of mind develops slowly, and on relative reality, it's useful. We organize our life around deadlines so that we can start this interview on time. But ultimately, we reify time. It becomes a solid structure. I begin to think it's an independently existing thing, like there's a external cosmic time clock out there. I even locate it in Greenwich. And that once I reify time like that, it has grab. So I rush around trying to meet deadlines, and it has lots of grab. And it has the capacity to obscure a level of awareness that's far beyond time and space and can never possibly go away if it doesn't operate in time. So any time in a Buddhist text you see the phrase beyond the three times, what they're talking about is you've found a meditation on emptiness of time that moves you beyond the structure of past, present, and future into a timeless state. So when you practice emptiness, what you're really doing is you're looking into the nature of these structures of mind so they're not so solid anymore, and you don't take them as independently existing. And if you can see them the way they are, what you end up seeing is always about something about the nature of awareness and opening up different levels of awareness. So, how do you practice that? Emptiness is a high-speed search. What you do is you take awareness, because awareness is much quicker than thought. For example, at one time we did work with a tachistoscope, which is a high-speed electronic board that will flash events in thousands of a second. In relatively standard luminance conditions, thought is rather slow. Thought occurs from about 500 to 2,000 milliseconds. And directing attention takes about 200 milliseconds. It's much quicker than thought. But awareness, it goes as fast as the machine will measure. The limits of the technology is about 8 milliseconds. Awareness works like the speed of light. So you see, you can use awareness to search through your experience at very high speeds and to try and find these structures of mind as independently existing. So let's say I start with emptiness of self. What I would do is take my awareness. I would start with Dan. First, you have to start with the target. I would bring to mind my sense of self, Danness. Notice, make myself familiar with all the personality characteristics and stories that go with Dan. Then I would take my awareness and I would roam through at high speeds the field of bodily experience. Can I find Dan in any part of my body? As an independently existing thing, anything in itself there that is that thing. Can I roam through and find Dan in any thought, specific thought or emotion or sight or sound? And as I roam through all my experience, the target that I'm looking for keeps slipping from my awareness. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama once summarized very succinctly, when you do emptiness as a meditation, it's always about unfindability. The target recedes from your awareness. Emptiness practice is what we call a affirming negation. Affirming negation means I negate X in order to affirm Y. So if I roam through, if I bring up Dan as the target I'm looking for, and I roam through all my experience, and it keeps slipping away, then I look at what's left, and what's left is the field of awareness itself. And what I'll end up affirming is a level of awareness that is cleaned up of the solidness of Dan. I don't have to get rid of Dan as a structure of mind. It just recedes into the background. And what shines forth is a level of awareness that's completely cleaned up of sense of self. And I'm going to call that Rangrigpa, awareness itself. Then once I open up that field of awareness that's no longer clouded over by this empty construction of personal identity, I can make that my basis of operation in the meditation. It's a technical term in Tibetan, it's a little difficult to translate, called churyul, which I like to translate as basis of operation. Where am I operating out of this moment? In my everyday life, ordinarily I operate out of thought mode. I dwell in thoughts. I operate out of Dan. I operate out of personal identity. But if I do the emptiness meditation correctly and roam around and search for the target and it keeps becoming unfindable and slips away, then what shines forth is a level of awareness that's freed up of that structure of mind. So I shift my basis of operation, or where I land is in awareness itself that's completely free of that. I don't get caught up in Dan, I don't get caught up in thought. If I do emptiness of thought, I open up a level of awareness that's not clouded over by thought. If I do emptiness of emotion practice, although the emotions will still exist, they lose grab, and I'm operating out of a level of awareness that isn't clouded over by emotions, positive or negative, however intense they are. And if I open up emptiness of time, I open up a level of awareness that's timeless. And since time and space are related, it's huge and boundless. And once I open up that, what we call changeless, boundless awareness, it's sort of convenient Because once I know that is a direct experience and that's my basis of operation, it can't go away because it doesn't come and go in time. And each one of these practices opens up a different level of awareness. So that's summarized in the very popular mantra of the Heart Sutra. And the Heart Sutra mantra goes like this. Gate, gate, paragate, parasam, gate, bodhisvaha. And it means, literally, gone, gone, gone way beyond, gone way, way beyond. What a realization. Ooh, what a realization. So let's unpack it. The first gate is about thought. We are lost in our thoughts in our everyday life. But if you train concentration, with, say, the elephant path, and stabilize that, one of the consequences of stabilizing concentration is thought elaboration will wind down and, for the relatively speaking, stop. Then what's left are periods of long stillness. And then you, in your direct experience, you can see the difference between awareness and thought. And now you're operating out of awareness mode rather than thought mode. That's your basis of operation. We call that Rigpa, or awareness. That's the first gate in the Heart Sutra. Awareness gone beyond thought. Then if you do emptiness of self practice and clean up that field of awareness from its being clouded over by self, then you open up a level of awareness that's beyond the sense of self or personal identity. That's the second gate, awareness itself. And we say Rang Rigpa, awareness itself, to mark it as a different level of awareness from the previous level. Awareness itself gone beyond personal identity. Then if I look at the structure of time and see how I reified that too much, I don't have to get rid of time, I just have to get rid of its capacity to obscure. I'll open up a level of awareness that's beyond time and space, that's changeless and boundless, like an ocean of awareness. And that's the paragate. And it's marked paragate because it's a much bigger shift in awareness. And that's called Rangi Rangmakpur, awareness in and of itself, or we like to call it ever-present or changeless, boundless awareness. And that opens up a remarkable level of mind, because when you use the emptiness of time meditations, you shift to what we call simultaneous mode. And this is a huge difference between that first turning of the wheel of Buddhism and the second, the Mahayana. Because in the old Buddhism, there's a certain depth of concentration called arising and passing away samadhi, where everything flashes very quickly like a stroboscope. And if you keep looking at that, eventually all that simplest movements of the mind will start breaking up and fragmenting and disappear. Like the simplest points that you can observe in the mind disappear. And it's not a very pleasant experience, but because all that activity of mind fragments and disappears, it's called Bhanganyana in Pali, or dissolution experience. You can then see this mirror-like awareness, and you can learn something about the nature of awareness freed up of all the stuff of the mind. And that's why it's called, in the older first turning of the wheel, the Theravadan Buddhism, it's called the platform for awakening, because you can look really into the nature of that awareness. But then the Nagarjuna came along in the Mahayana and said, look, the idea that things seem to come and go in the mind presumes the construction of time. And if that's just an empty construction of mind, it's its own illusion, then it opens up a different kind of experience. So he developed this thing called the Nagarjuna dialectic. And if something comes forth in time, I take the view that it's not really coming forth because it's already here. And if something goes away in time, I take the view that it doesn't go anywhere but stays here. And that's going to screw around with time. And if I then look into the nature of the field of awareness at the same time, then what's going to open up is a field of awareness that's outside of the operations of things seeming to come and go in time. It's always here. It's changeless. It's boundless. It's a huge shift. And that opens up a different kind of operation of mind where everything is here all at once because it doesn't operate temporally in time anymore. Everything is interconnected, and everything here is all at once. That's the gateway and the beginning of Mahayana, the great vehicle. Because if I open up in my direct experience a level of awareness where everything is interconnected within that ocean-like field of awareness, it will change your ethics. Because everything that you think, everything you do, affects everything in the field. And it leads to a rather profoundly different world view of the universe, because everything is interconnected. Now, let's take emptiness of self and emptiness of time in Mahayana Buddhism and look at it in terms of the topic that you brought up tonight, in terms of the world's challenges. We are at a crisis. And part of the crisis is that the banking industry around the world is flawed. And what makes it so flawed is good old selfishness and greed. People wanting more and more for themselves and sheltering all that in tax structures, you know, and not paying any taxes. So you get a wealthy people who make more and more and more at the expense of the rest of the world. We're not going to survive with that kind of selfishness. But if we can change people's consciousness so they begin to have that immediate experience of interconnectedness, then, and if they practice emptiness of self, you don't get rid of self, you get rid of the grab of self, then all that greed doesn't matter anymore, because you've directly experienced a much larger vision of the mind. I teach a lot in Europe. We teach a lot in the courses in Switzerland. And a lot of our students are CEOs or are bankers. And some of them have been stunned by the realizations of these practices, and now we're talking about collaborative banking and using it for more socially conscious projects. I wouldn't presume to be able to make a dent in Wall Street at the moment. We've got a much better shot at changing the banking industry in Europe with these practices because they're more open to it. But the realizations do lead to a rather different experience of the mind and the world. And to go back to the Heart Sutra, if you continue to open up those practices at what we call the extraordinary level of mind, where everything is interconnected, and you're operating out of a kind of ocean-like awareness, and everything that comes up are like waves in the ocean that have no grab and no substance anymore, there's one last cloud, and that's our information processing system. You see, always right here, every moment, awakening shines forth. Always right here, every moment, there's a boundless ocean of empty awareness space on the one hand, and an ocean of love, the two sides of the same thing. That is your true nature that shines forth all of the time. You are never apart from that. It's part of the hardwiring. But it's clouded over by all these solid, seemingly too solid structures of mind. And the last set of clouds is our information processing system. Every time the mind directs itself to pay attention to this or that, I'm partializing. Every time I conceptualize, I'm partializing. Mipham, one of the great Dzogchen scholars, says the purpose of conceptualization is to delineate. And as soon as I say it's this, it's not that. And I'm partializing. And any tendency of partializing clouds over the unbounded wholeness that's always right here. So in Mahamudra and in Dzogchen, there are what we call crossing over instructions. There are special, precious instructions that at the right level of practice will help you to cut beyond conceptualizing, to cut beyond the tendency to pay attention, to cut beyond even the slightest tendency to go towards anything, to make it something particular that will preclude you from directly experiencing the wholeness of that awakening that's always here. And with those instructions, you'll open that up and move beyond the cloud of moment-by-moment information processing. Every moment has the potential to cloud over true nature that's always here. And when you understand that, that's parasamgata, gone way, way beyond the constraints of your individual consciousness to awakened awareness. Ooh, what a realization. Parasamgata bodhisvaha. So the whole path is contained within that mantra. And the outcome of that awakening, if you have a genuine awakening and it's not conceptual, because some people like to think they want to, they like to think they're awakened and they're not, and the self can't be awakened because the self is a cloud that gets in the way of awakening. But usually if it's genuine, it's accompanied by deep compassion, spontaneous gratitude and devotion, because one directly knows the profundity of what they've realized. It's usually not very stable. And there's a whole other set of methods that will help you to they're called kyungwa, to nurture it, to develop it so you have it all the time on and off the pillow. And then there's a whole other world of practices that bring that stable awakening up to full Buddhahood. And those practices are important, because if you can train awakening so you have it all the time, then there's a certain level of this practice where everything arises within the infinite vast expanse of the groundless ground of your being. And everything arises as spontaneously present, leaving no trace. It just disappears and leaves no trace. And what's different about that level of practice within that domain of what we call spacious freedom is not only do things have no grab, but there's no engagement of what comes up. Because anytime you engage something, anytime the mind moves towards it or moves away from it, that impulse to engage it is what causes karmic impressions. And if you open up this level of the boundless space of groundless ground where everything arises and disappears, leaving no trace, and you do that every moment, then you are forming no new karmic impressions. So it forces the mind to release all the previous karmic impressions at an accelerated rate. And that process is called Dharmadhatu exhaustion. And the end point of that, which is some texts, takes about, depending on how you do it, takes on the average about 2 to 6 years. The end point of that is that there are no negative states left in your experience, ever. And what then comes forth is the flourishing of all the positive states which are part of your Buddha nature. There are 80 positive qualities of a Buddha mind. One time, years ago, Jack Engler and I gave Rorschach inkblots to people at various stages of meditation. And those who had achieved an initial taste of awakening but wasn't stable, the Rorschachs looked like ordinary Rorschachs, except when we scored them with the whole system for defensiveness. They had no defensiveness. Everything was there, and it's consistent with this idea that what drops away is reactivity moment by moment. But they still had a lot of conflicts. But when we looked at the people at the highest stages, the great saints and masters, what was remarkable is their Rorschach showed a complete absence of any negative states at all. They've extinguished all negative states, and everything was positive. The primordial Buddha in Indo-Tibetan Buddhism is in Sanskrit called Samantabhadra, but I like the Tibetan name. In Tibetan, it's called Kuntuzangpo. And Kuntuzangpo literally means everything good. If you develop this path, the outcome is that you experience everything good, all positive states and no negative states. And since that arises within the field of an ocean-like expanse of mind, everything about your practice affects everything in the field, which means it's like planting seeds that will in the whole field of humanity that will eventually ripen into the eradication of negative states and the flourishing of positive states in an interconnected sea of beings. It's not like that everybody awakens along with you, But it is like that you plant what's called Wong influence, and it pulls all of humanity along in a positive direction by the force of that realization. And ultimately, when you get to that third map of what's called Buddha training map, there are, you exhaust all negative states, you have the flourishing of all positive states, perception gets extraordinary, everything turns to light and energy and nothing's solid anymore, so the world gets pretty magical. The body becomes clear light body, so not even the body is solid. And that you begin to see that this unfolding of awakened awareness has its own intelligence and organizing capacity. And then entire worlds unfold, what are called Buddha fields and Buddha realms. And that you get complete downloads of teachings. And that what opens up is levels and levels of all-at-onceness. If you look at the room right now, you're existing in a bubble. And at some point, what we say in Dzogchen, the eggshell cracks. And you see that there are thousands and thousands of bubbles. And the spaciousness of awakened awareness begins to pervade and saturate all those bubbles. In some of the old sutras, the degree of Buddhahood was measured in terms of the thousands upon thousands of worlds that you open up. And then the only thing that's left to develop is what's called chirpa, conduct. The mind spontaneously will have the impulse of compassion to be of the benefit to all beings. The ultimate test of any realization is always chirpa, conduct. And when you have spontaneous conduct that's the best fit for the situation at hand, for all beings, at all times, and your mind operates on multiple levels of reality at once, that's called trinle, enlightened activity, the ultimate realization of a full realized Buddha. So there's your path.
Thank you so much, Dan. That was exquisite. And is exquisite.
Yes, profound.
What a gift.
And simple.
Well, here we are at the top of the hour, and we're supposed to have some announcements now. If you have a question for Dan, if you're listening by phone, you can raise your hand by pressing star 2 on your keypad. And if you're listening by computer, you can type a question in the teleseminar window. But first, I'd like to make sure you know how to find out more about Dan's work. He's written a really wonderful book that elaborates these teachings in rich detail, pointing out the great way, the stages of meditation in the Mahamudra tradition. There are other resources online at pointingoutway.org.
Yeah, that's probably the best, because the pointingoutway.org website gives the schedule for retreats, and the best way to learn this stuff is to practice it rather than reading about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Please stay on the line. At the end of the call, I'll tell you about my next guest on the program, David Gershon, who's a remarkable activist and social change artist. And I see we do have some questions, so let's get to them. First of all, you know, there's in order to expand the scope of this conversation, there's a question from somebody you know very well, not far away from you, Federico. He thought it would be interesting to bring up your expertise in attachment theory and the importance of creating secure and genuine attachment bonds with those we love for living a thriving life, and explore the relationship between that and the non-attachment so talked about in Buddhism.
Yeah, well, they're simply because we use the word attachment, they're completely different things. In Western psychology, We have 50 years of research on early infant caregiver attachment. We can study attachment with a standardized play lab observational system called the strain situation paradigm. You bring an infant who's usually 12 to 20 months into the playroom with the mother. You don't give them any instructions. There's a couple chairs around and toys on the floor and a big plastic box filled with toys. And you watch them, what the mother and child do, and for 3 minutes, and then a stranger comes in, and you watch the child's response to the stranger, and then after 3 minutes, the mother's asked to leave, and you see what it's like for the child to be with a stranger alone, and then the mother comes back, and the stranger leaves, and you see the child's response, and then another time, the child is alone for 3 minutes, and in that standard observation, you see one of four patterns emerging. And this is based on the work of John Bowlby, where basically when children have what we call secure attachment, they have a secure base with the caregiver, it fosters healthy exploratory behavior. So secure kids are always socially referencing the mom, and then it makes them explore more in the playroom. They show greater complexity of play behavior and greater organization of mind. They protest in a healthy way when the mother leaves. They prefer the mother over the stranger. They're comfortable with closeness. And those secure infants are going to grow up comfortable with intimacy. And then avoidant or dismissing kids, they go for the toys. They have amplified exploratory behavior at the expense of attachment. They've deactivated the attachment system. There's no social referencing. They don't show preference for the mother over the stranger, or they don't care whether there's anybody in the rooms or not, they just go for the toys. But they're somewhat aggressive and frustrated in the play. Dismissing, avoidant kids grow up to have a dismissing style of attachment. They have difficulty with forming relationships. There's a clear relationship between aggressive behavior and dismissing attachment. Most domestic battering is caused by people who have dismissing attachment. A lot of adolescents who are incarcerated have dismissing attachment. Adolescents who engage in forcible rape have dismissing attachment. Anxious, preoccupied kids, or what we call ambivalent kids, they show the opposite, is the dismissing. They have essentially over-exaggerated attachment and inhibited exploratory behavior. So they're very tentative in the playroom. They cling to the mother too much. They get disorganized in their anxiety when the mother leaves, and they show remarkable inhibited play behavior. As adults, they have a poorly developed sense of self, and they tend to cue too much off of caretaking other people at the expense of their own needs. And disorganized kids show a mixture of dismissing and anxious, preoccupied elements. Why that's important is that we know now from 50 years of research that kids who have in one of the three types of insecure attachment are going to grow up to have significant mental health problems, particularly the ones with disorganized attachment. Ones who have disorganized attachment who are later abused are highly likely to grow up with a diagnosis of a personality disorder and a dissociative disorder 20 years, 30 years later. So some of my work in the last 20 years has been on trying to develop methods to repair attachment pathology in children and adults so they get back on the right track again. In this society, the base rates are that one out of three individuals grows up to have insecure attachment of one form or another. So that's different from some other child-focused countries where secure attachment is 80%. So as we move into a world where parents sort of warehouse their kids and engage in what we call instrumental love, they schlep the kids around and never pay attention to them, then secure attachment goes down in terms of base rate. So the worst thing you can do is sort of be present but not present to your kids. If you want to have kids, you have to be attentive to them in their internal state at all times and watch their growth with great joy. But now we are in a society of instrumental love where people are just raising kids for the sake of having kids and not really attending to pay for that in terms of mental health problems years later. So, in a culture like Tibetan culture, if people didn't have good attachment, then you repair that by using secure mother figures like Green Tara in a visualization, and she has all the qualities of perfect attachment. And if you do the visualization over and over again, you can remap it. Our treatment of Westerners with attachment problems uses structured visualizations. Of course, Westerners don't know Green Tara, but we have them imagine ideal parent figures in supplying all the right qualities of secure attachment, and through the repeated visualizations, they can positively remap the attachment system. On our website, there's a tab for supporting materials for the practice, and there's a more detailed lecture on the five basic ingredients of healthy attachment, and then there's a visualization practice. We've taken traditional, what's called manam, all beings as mothers, in Tibetan, which doesn't make any sense to Westerners, and sort of modified it with modern attachment theory and redone the visualization in a way that works better for Westerners. So anybody can download that as a free download on the website. Now, that's not the same thing as what in Buddhism is called non-attachment, and I don't like the term non-attachment. I think it's a misunderstanding of what happens in Buddhism. I think that one, through the first level of the turning of the wheel, the Theravadin practices, learns a kind of non-reactive awareness. But in Mahayana, the second turning of the wheel, and the essence traditions, the third turning of the wheel, there's no encouragement of the practice of non-attachment. In fact, we use in the essence traditions, we use the stuff of everyday reality, and relative reality is the vehicle for awakening. So to put yourself in the midst of samsara and to open up your awakening, it deepens much better in the midst of samsara than in some quiet state. So there's no notion of this, of non-attachment here. And you fully immerse yourself in the world and live life fully and hopefully flourish without any grab and with service to others, inexhaustible service to others. That's a better life to live. Now, Mahayana in Buddhism and in the essence traditions raises a fundamental question: what constitutes the good life? You train the mind until there's no negative states, you have the flourishing of all positive states, and ultimately you become a service to humanity, because the practice, what's built into the hard wiring of awakening, is compassion. Every moment becomes for the benefit of others. That's a good life.
It is a delight to be with the range of rigor and eloquence that you bring to all these topics. Looking at a lot of people have been typing in questions. You've really given a lot of gifts here, and people are very activated and have a lot of questions on a variety of different fronts. There's quite a cluster of questions that kind of go back to my originating question in the series. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any one of them that is the point so much, but I think there's a question as to how awakening can come together and with an impulse toward activism and actively changing the world. And
because awakening comes in the context of relative reality. You use the stuff of relative reality as the medium for awakening. You're not apart from that. You're never apart from that. So the question is a false bifurcation. Relative reactivity, samsara, is nirvana. If you have a genuine awakening, then there's no distinction here. There's no duality. And you live life fully in the everyday world. The issue is where you're living it from. You're living it from the point of being that ocean-like awareness, love. And every impulse comes from that ocean of awareness, love, towards others, without any duality. It's a false distinction. We don't think like that.
Now, there are a couple of specific questions here that I think would be useful to go into, and one of them is a request for you to go into the emptiness of emotions again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can do it both with positive and negative emotions, and with you do, emptiness is always a high-speed search task. So first you start by either working with a spontaneous arising emotion, or you can generate the emotion through visualization. So let's say we take a negative emotion like fear. If fear comes up, you work with it. How will you know? Because it has grab. You can feel the grab of the fear. Or you can visualize an experience and imagine a time that you were especially fearful and keep imagining and feel your way back into that situation until you can generate the fear right now. So that's what we call familiarizing yourself with the target. Then you take your awareness and you roam around through regions of the body. Find fear. And keep looking around in there. And everywhere you look, it will recede from your awareness. If you think you find it, roam around it more carefully. If you think you find fear in your heart, what chamber of the heart is it in? If you think you find it in a certain chamber, roam around in the muscle tissue. What cells is it in? If you think you find it in certain cells, look into the molecules within the cells and the subatomic particles. And at some point, if you break it down into smaller units of analysis and roam around with high-speed awareness, it's unfindable. It slips from your awareness. That's the negation part of the affirming negation. Then what's left? Now, it's always about the field of awareness. But with emotions, what's left and what you'll affirm is what we call the liveliness of awareness. Awareness isn't a static thing. From the mind side of the equation, we say the awareness knows, shayrik, knowing awareness. From the event side of the equation, we say that awareness has tzal, it has liveliness. Awareness is always expressing itself to itself for the purpose of knowing itself. All emotions, all sights, all sounds, all smells, all tastes, all touch sensations, all thought, all emotions are the liveliness of awareness. It's all lively awareness. There's none other than that. So what gets affirmed about that particular emotion is what we call the pure energy of manifestation of that emotion. You're not going to get rid of the emotion. You're going to get rid of its grab, and you're going to get rid of its capacity to obscure the real nature of lively awareness. And at the end of that search, you've shifted your basis of operation, so you're operating out of being that lively awareness, cleaned up of the stories, the labels of fear. And it's a positive thing. What's left is a kind of, with fear, it's a kind of remarkable alertness, the pure energy of manifestation of lively awareness. So you first search through areas of the body until it's unfindable, and then you affirm the liveliness, the pure energy of manifestation of that awareness. Then you evoke the target again. You go back and evoke the fear, and you search through physiological systems. Can you find it in the GI tract? Can you find it in the muscle skeletal system, in the nervous system, until it's unfindable? And then you affirm the pure energy of manifestation of lively awareness. And then you evoke the emotion again from whatever the original situation is, and now you search for the self. Find the self that has the fear, that has the fear, and you roam around in that until it slips from your awareness, and you end up affirming the liveliness. You shift your basis of operation into the liveliness of that field of expressed lively awareness, the pure energy of manifestation of it. And each time you do it, the liveliness of that state shines forth more and more like the sun. Then the fear has no grab anymore. You didn't get rid of the fear, you got rid of its capacity, its reactivity. So you can do the same thing with positive emotions. It's a good idea to do that with love and compassion. You're not going to get rid of the love and compassion. You're going to get rid of the label. You're going to get rid of its all the stories that go with it. You're going to get rid of its the clinging of the self to that love and compassion. What's going to be left is the pure energy of manifestation of that. And it's particularly with compassion, it's important to clean it up with it with emptiness practice. Otherwise, then a lot of compassion comes to be self-serving. We've destroyed entire cultures in the name of love, you know, through missionary behavior. But if love and compassion is cleaned up of the issue of self, it doesn't come from me. I don't want anything back from it. In that case, love becomes like the sun. It's inexhaustible energy, and it has its rays that shine everywhere inexhaustibly. The sun doesn't shine, decide who to shine on. It sends its rays everywhere impartially, equally, and everyone is touched by its warmth. Better to be the sun. Then the compassion is cleaned up and has no self-grab and goes everywhere inexhaustibly.
I'm so glad I asked you that question. We have several people with their hands up. I'd like to give you an opportunity to interact with at least one or two callers.
Sure,
John
sure.
Perez in San Francisco.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yes.
You're on the call.
Thank you. In regards to letting go of this grab and, really being online and attunement with awareness, it brings me back to the concentration meditation. I was just curious if there's one, like, practice or method that you discuss with your students to really enhance that.
To enhance concentration?
Yes, and you talked about, bringing the attention, back onto the object, but is there something more, like, tangible and specific?
Well, yeah, there's a whole path there. There's 9 stages to the mind staying. We start with a concentration object. I like to start with using the rising and falling of the breath. We call it the 3-point object. Direct the mind like a steering wheel towards the rising breath, then direct it towards the falling breath, and then in the interval between the breaths, take the felt sense of the body. Because if you don't fill up that interval between the breaths, the more concentrated you get, the longer that interval is going to be, and you're going to fill it up with thought and keep canceling out the concentration. But if you keep the mind busy on rising, then falling, then on the felt sense of the body, it's always focusing on the concentration object, so it tends to deepen. But in Asanga's system, the key component is the flames of intensifying. You stay so closely and busily engaged with the object, the mind doesn't race off anywhere else. Oh, I like to think about it in terms of when my boys were younger and I would take them to a dude ranch and ride trail horses in the Rockies, and when they weren't very experienced, they would get on a horse and the horse would take 2 steps and then go off the side of the path and start munching grass, and then they would pull it back and it would take 3 more steps and start going another direction and munching grass until they did what? They figured out if they held the reins tighter and not gave the horse so much play, it stayed on the trail. And like that, when you intensify, you hold the reins of the mind so close on the object, you don't give it play to chase after that thought. And so the key is intensifying and not allowing yourself to engage in all that thought stuff. Just turn it away as quickly as you can. The art is to catch the thoughts more, to catch yourself going off more and more immediately. We're calling that catching it at the head rather than the tail end of it. And turning it back every time. Even if you have to bring it back thousands of times, there's a learning curve, and then it just starts to stay. And what we look for at the beginning, the first stage of the 9 stage of the elephant path, the mind stays less on the object and more. If you add more intensifying, you can get to the 2nd stage where the mind stays more on the object and not. A good benchmark from progress is that you're staying on the concentration object for somewhere between 50% and 80% of the time of the session, and it's not lost in thought. However, when you get in that range, you're going to go through a phase where it looks like there's a lot more background noise than there was before, and that's not the case. So you can mistakenly conclude that your concentration is deteriorated. What's really happening is you're aware that you've been dividing your attention between the concentration object and the background noise. We call that partial staying, nature. So usually at that point what we do is have you break the object down into smaller pieces so you stay so busy on it that you just don't have time to engage in all that background noise of thought. So we'll switch to what's called the 7-point object. Focus on this. See if you can pick up the exact moment in real time that the rising breath begins. Follow everything it's about its duration and see if you can pick out the exact endpoint that it stops. Nice clean stop. Beginning of the rising breath, everything is about its duration. Exact point, the end point of the falling breath, and then back to the felt sense of the body. And since you were giving it more structure at that point, it keeps you so busy trying to follow the object that all that background noise at that point just drops off. And what you'll see is there are long periods of stillness with thought activity that doesn't get very elaborated. You're not going to get lost in these elaborated daydreams. If thoughts come up, they're rather fleeting, and they're usually just associated with keeping the meditation on track. And then once you have what we call continuous staying over time and complete staying, so you're not dividing your attention in a given time, but staying completely on the object, then you've mastered the third stage of the elephant path. And it goes on like that. There's a set of methods for each one of those stages. But in a pointing out style, where you're being followed really carefully and you're being walked through it, you should be able to get most of those stages down in a reasonable way in about 3 days, 3 or 4 days. Unless you're
Thank you.
At a thought. Does that make it clear?
Yeah, no, the rising and falling and the anticipation is very clear. It gives me something to work with. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, there's one typed-in question that I think you could answer pretty quickly that I think quite a few people would be interested in. A fellow is asking if what you think of these brainwave technology tapes that people sometimes listen to while meditating.
I'm not a strong fan of them because EEG is a sort of a crude measure. We've gone way beyond that with functional MRI, where you can actually look at neurocircuitry and see which areas of the brain or which related circuits light up around given tasks. And EEG is much more crude than that. And I'm not sure that is specific enough. So even with the best EEG that we have, which is 16 channel, you can't pinpoint it enough to get down to something like the ACC activation that I talked about earlier. So it leads to the illusion that you're relaxing, but meditation isn't relaxing. So we unfortunately have confused meditation in the West with relaxation therapy, but anybody who meditates knows it's hard work. It's not relaxing at all. In fact, if you relax too much, the mind wanders more. Way back in 1970, Akishige at Kyoto University wired up beginning and advanced Zen monks with EMG to measure striate muscle activity during meditation. And what he found was surprised everybody. Contrary to Benson's work on the so-called relaxation response, Akishige found that meditation wasn't relaxing. From the point of view of the body, it's even output and distribution of muscle work. If you hold up the upper trunk of the body and sit in a lotus or a half lotus posture and hold that for 30 minutes, it's a lot of output of energy. But what Akishige found is it did two things. One is it guaranteed a certain minimal level of alertness so you don't get dull and sleepy. And secondly, the mind wandered less, not more, as a result of holding up the posture. Whereas if you lie on the floor and start meditating, you're going to get dull and sleepy and the mind's going to wander more and it's harder to train it. So the foundation is always posture because it keeps the mind alert and it's not relaxing at all. It's just work, but it leads to a more positive end.
Thanks, Dan. Do you have time to stay a little late? We could take one more question, perhaps. Great. Tom Boogsty, hi.
Hi there, Terry. Hi, Dan. This is Tom.
Hi, Bob. Nice to hear your voice. How are you doing?
Yeah, nice to hear you. And it's wonderful to hear your profound...
Are you still out there in cowboy country?
What
Where are you living now?
I'm in Wyoming still.
Yeah, that's my thought.
Yes. But I really loved your comprehensive description of the process. And I was wondering if you've thought about... Based on the rather dire nature of our interaction with the world, in terms of how we're devolving it as fast as we're evolving it, just about, if you thought about particular practices that people could use that are at the level of their development in that process, where they can take it out in the community in a sense and live it in that samsara, as you said.
Well, you know, that's why when we do these retreats, we race through the concentration just to get your mind to be a stable tool, but then we focus on the emptiness practices because they're designed for everyday life. Emptiness will remove the grab from life and remove the clouds. And hopefully you shift your levels of awareness so that you're operating out of this awareness where everything arises without any grab, so you experience the taste of spacious freedom. And you have a sense of everything being and everyone being interconnected within the field of that larger awareness. That is, you can do that in all the time, all day long. And that your personal experience will lose grab, and because you appreciate the interconnectedness of everybody and everything, then it spontaneously and naturally leads to a softening of the mind and to compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So we emphasize the emptiness practices and living life with that view all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that. I will continue practicing that more conscientiously than what I have been.
They're designed for everyday life.
Yes. That's what we need to do to accelerate our growth.
I don't see meditation in terms of sitting practice. It's a way of being. It's a way of living every moment. It's a view that you have about and where you with the level of awareness that you're operating out of. The
mm-hmm.
view is the meditation. The view is the meditation.
And that view is our life.
No, the view is where you're operating out of.
Mm-hmm.
The best would be operating out of awakened awareness, or even better, operating out of groundless ground, or even better, operating out of Buddha bodies, full Buddhahood.
Yeah.
It's not what you're looking at, it's where you're looking from. But there's no duality in that, only in the words.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing this
nice to talk
important and profound offering to everyone.
Oh, my pleasure. Completely my pleasure.
Thank you, Tom. Please stay on the phone so we can say goodbye to Dan and thank him. We're at the end of our time, so I want to make sure if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And I want to make sure everybody gets Dan's website. It's pointingoutway.org, pointingoutway.org. I also want to invite you to go to terrypatton.com. to look at my blog entries and sign up for my personal mailing list, which is different from this course. There's quite a lot that I'm doing. For instance, this Wednesday, for those of you in the Bay Area, Joanna Macy will be at Beyond Awakening. And just less than 3 weeks from today, on Sunday, May 26th, at our regular time, 10 a.m. Pacific, I'm looking forward to speaking with transformational social change agent, climate change activist, best-selling author, and former White House advisor David Gershon, whose latest book is Social Change 2.0, A Blueprint for Reinventing Our World. That's Sunday, May 26th, at our usual time, 10 a.m. Pacific. Thank you so much for joining Dan and me today. Let's all say goodbye.
Thank you for organizing something around social issues. It's important if we're going to survive. I appreciate your presence of mind to do that.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much, Dan. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, friends.
Goodbye.
Thank
Bye.
You, Dan.
Bye. Blessings.
Thank you, Terry and Dan.
Bye, Dan.
Thank you, everybody.
Hello.